Welcome to the Women in Fire radio show. Today we'll be talking about with our presenters from our Women in Fire conference, leadership conference. I'd like to thank Fire and Engineering for allowing Women in Fire to be part of the radio show. I'm Lisa Baker, retired battalion chief and the Southwest Region trustee. So, like I mentioned, today I'll be speaking with some of our presenters who will be at our leadership conference held at FDIC, which will be on Monday, April 15th. It'll kick off with an opening ceremony, followed by a lineup of educational classes that will provide training, support, and advocacy for not only women in the fire service, but men as well. So I'm very excited with the panel I have today. We have some excellent instructors with us. So we will start out with Battalion Chief Carrie Henderson. And Carrie, if you could just tell us the class you're teaching and a brief overview, please.
Sure. Hi, I'm Carrie Henderson, and I am a battalion chief with James City County Fire Department, which is Williamsburg, Virginia area. So think Busch Gardens, Anheuser-Busch area, if you're not familiar with that area of Virginia. So pardon me, it's 8 p.m. here. I'm exhausted. I've had a long day. So if this is just all over the place, I apologize in advance. So my class is really about the soft skills of leadership. So it's empathy and compassion, authenticity. These aren't just safe space words. And so this class kind of came together in an interesting way. I usually co-teach it with my business partner, Kyle Matusik. He's out of Oak Brook, Illinois. And so 2 years ago, we both submitted for the Darley Leadership Essay Contest. Darley and Company makes fire pumps and a bunch of cool fire products and military stuff. And we were the first and second place winners of that contest. And they offered us a speaking engagement at Teeks. And we had never met, but we read each other's essays and decided we would like to co-teach that class together. Topics that really went well together. It's one of those encounters where you meet somebody and you read what they're talking about, and you're like, yes, you're speaking my language. And so we usually co-teach this class together. But for Women of Fire, in at FDIC, I am teaching this class by myself. So it'll be my own personal story. And the way the class kind of works is, like most folks in the fire service, I took all the classes you could take looking for a recipe for leadership. And I thought I would find a class that would say, step one, do this, step two, do this. And Carrie tried all the steps from all the people, and I just couldn't find what felt genuine to me. It felt like I was trying on someone else's style, and I was. And what it really took, and what Kyle and I both experienced, was it took personal self development. It took introspection to get an authentic leadership style. So this class is really very personal stories of some things that we went through. I'm going to tell my story, and I'm going to tell Kyle's story as well, because I think it helps the class. It does it more justice, of how we ended up there. It's therapy. It's setting personal values. And it's your own personal work that helps you develop your genuine, authentic style of leadership. And sometimes, in the fire service, we're rough and tough, and that comes across as soft. And people will say that's too soft, or that's too safe space, or whatever it is. But I kind of work through the class to show, once you learn to set your own personal values and where they come from, and once you help your crew or your company set theirs, that you can really, really elevate expectations. And you can take your expectations and your performance to a whole nother level, because you've really, really personally gotten to know your crew and your people, and they know you. And once they know your values, they understand where your expectations come from. And once you know theirs, you can help meet their expectations and push them. And it really translates not just to the four walls of the firehouse, but out onto emergency scenes. They feel safe and confident. It helps with decision making, and just really setting high expectations. So I try to break that stereotype that this is soft, because it really is hard. It's hard work. And then it really makes a huge difference in your group dynamics and how you are as a leader.
Thanks for sharing that, Chief. That sounds like a really interesting class.
Thank you.
Next, we have Assistant Chief Robert Leonard. You're on mute.
Microphone was off. Thank you for having me on the show. I want to especially thank Women in Fire. This is the first conference I've been picked to speak at that I didn't apply to speak at. It was sort of a surprise to get the additional invite to join your conference, and that's a great opportunity. My class is called Crisis Management: Our Own When Bad Things Happen to Good Fire Departments, and we're going to talk that day about the fact that we prepare for everyone else's crisis, but do we prepare for our own? Do we sit and think about how we're going to react the day the apparatus crashes into a school bus, or the day when news cameras show up because one of our members has been involved in an off-duty incident, or there's been worse, an incident in the firehouse? You look as recently as the news headlines here in my own New York region. We had some members of the FDNY, EMS, and the fire suppression bureaus get into it at a patient care scene, and it made the cover of the New York Post. We will talk about both volunteer and career. My background, I've been very lucky and privileged to be in one of the smallest fire departments in probably the country and in the city of New York. There are nine volunteer fire departments still in the city, and I was a captain in one of those, running with the FDNY as a volunteer. I was the deputy director of press at the FDNY itself, and I still work on media relations for fire departments all across the country, small and large career and volunteer. And the same way fire doesn't discriminate between men and women or your color of your skin, crises don't discriminate either. They impact all fire departments, small or large. So whether your participants are career officers or leaders, or volunteer officers or leaders, we will talk about some of the common crises facing fire departments, how to prevent them, and if we can't prevent them, how to deal with them, mostly from a communication standpoint. Communications, I feel, is key during these episodes, communicating with the public that you serve, with your own members, with your leadership team. I do wish I did have my class same time as Chief Henderson's class. I had to go to her class for some of those soft skills, but they come in pretty handy when you're trying to explain to the mayor why your fire truck, drove into a school bus, or why the volunteer treasurer absconded with $50,000 in the treasury and the town supervisor wants to know what's going on at the firehouse, or why member X and member Y got into, fisticuffs at a scene. I just saw another big municipality fire department on the East Coast on TikTok. The chauffeur and a member were fighting at the side of the truck, and you're all smiling. I won't say what city it was, in the middle of the street as a jogger jogged by with his GoPro, and there were the members going at it. So I think, like good fire prevention, a lot of crises can be prevented, and we'll try to do some thought-provoking work. I'm not an attorney, but we'll talk about some legal concepts to help protect yourselves from liability. But more importantly, from a public relations and communication standpoint, perception is everything. And I think to leave the community with the perception that no matter how bad things are going, you are there prepared to serve them, even if, God forbid, you have a line of duty death, will the truck show up the next day? Yes, it will. We'll get mutual aid. We'll have guys and ladies come in from other tours, other cities to cover. But we'll also deal with our own crisis in an appropriate fashion. We'll talk about isolated crises. We lose a single house. We have one single bad response time. We have one episode of bad behavior. Then we discuss systemic crises when your fire department response time is consistently bad for months, career or volunteer, when you've had multiple episodes of employee malfeasance or misfeasance on or off duty, and you haven't done anything about it. Where's your background check process? What was your screening process to hire or to take on these volunteer or career members? That boxes should be checked long before the crisis hits. And I'm laughing, Lisa, as a fan over your head and your room that you're in. We say before the fit hits the shan, you want to have your crisis plan in place. You want to be prepared. So we will discuss how to prepare that crisis plan and how to communicate through it to your members, again, to the community you serve, and to the news media and the government officials that we all answer to.
Quick question, are you going to use any kind of case studies where incidents you've mentioned some incidences? Are you going to use?
Yes, absolutely. We use videos, real news videos. We talk about a variety of different types of incidents. We talk about social media getting folks into trouble and the eventual trouble that comes from that. So we will definitely lean into some of those things. And what I like to do, like just the week before, I may even drop in some fresh slides of what's going on in the country right before. I teach this class primarily to volunteer departments, but it applies applicably to career departments. I did a simple Google search. You'll see the slide if you come to the class. I Google searched the words volunteer fire department treasurer, and the first 24 entries on Google, two full pages, were news stories about theft from volunteer fire departments in many different places. They weren't from one city. It didn't say treasurer wins the award for being the best accountant. It didn't say treasurer has 50 years of service. And unfortunately, news stories rise to the top in Google. But you think about the volunteer service in particular, but in the career service, there's opportunity to unfortunately put things in your pocket and walk away with them. That can be a problem. So we will look at case studies, both historically, Chief, but also more recently to try and keep it contemporary for the folks in the room.
Thank you. Our next speaker is firefighter Amanda Miller.
Hi.
Hi, Amanda.
Can you hear me?
Barely.
I'm wrong here. Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can hear you now.
Better? Okay. Are you good? Are you ready?
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead. Sorry.
Okay, all right. I'll roger that. I'm firefighter Amanda Miller. I'm out of Chattanooga, Tennessee. I'll be presenting a program of sorts that I developed with basically system of ideas that anybody can see from.
Amanda, we're having a hard time hearing. I'm having a hard time hearing you. I don't know if anyone else is.
Yeah. Can y'all hear me now?
Yes, we can hear. I can hear you now.
All right. I apologize for that. I'm not techno savvy. This is just my first year with a smartphone. I had a flip phone before this, and now I have a smartphone. So I apologize. All right. I'll start over. I'm firefighter Amanda Miller. I'm from Chattanooga, Tennessee. I work at 4 different fire agencies at the moment. I'm a former combat Marine sergeant, deployed 3 times. I say that because my program was inspired by multiple crashes in my division. We lost a lot of guys. When I got out, I got fire service. We didn't know this was a way to serve something bigger than myself and have the brotherhood that I was looking for. And unfortunately, I started dating friends that disturbed me because of my background. I don't know if you've heard of the Swiss cheese model that the Navy put together. But I just started seeing almost mirror problems. And basically, it's the program, it's a system of ideas that anybody can take a choose and use what they will from it. It's based on line of duty death finding, sport science, marine, military science, and just science across all the disciplines. And basically what it is it deals with, centers on something called gear work, which is firefighter getting in any level of gear, bunker pants, or full on full gear, and moving around it. It doesn't help. It can just be swinging a sledge at a tire, or it can be full on high rise walking around. But any level of gear for the purpose of improving fire ground performance before the fire happens. I've interviewed 110 people across the country at this point. I don't plan on stopping these interviews. Documented very disturbing stories of people who are passionate, firefighters who are passionate, that are hitting some roadblocks. And the whole idea of the program is that there's no such thing as just a firefighter. With the title firefighter, there comes an intrinsic kind of power. And we can leverage their passion, their power, in ways that maybe we haven't thought of before. I think fire service, from my view, struggles with what to do with passionate firefighters. So this program basically takes gear work, where you get a firefighter a set of gear, and they invite anybody and everybody. Basically, I'll be going over how consistent gear work actually creates adaptive responses, physiology like activation or production of heat shock protein, increased plasma volume, improved cardiac output, and reduced chance of cancer. Also, stress inoculation, getting used to the weight of the gear, you know, better outcomes, think better. Again, using science to back this all up. And then going over something called feeding cohesion, which I'm borrowing from the military, and also backing that up with something called neural synchrony. So the idea that you and me, we can throw a set of gear on, go work together, proven that when we go operationally on a fire ground, we perform it. It's not magic. They actually put little electrodes on people's brains and conduct these very basic experiments. And even out in the field with the military, it's proven. So it basically take, get in gear, invite everybody, you build your confidence, you work on your soft skills, but it also works on your work as an opportunity. So you've got firefighters, I'm totally ripping off the Marine Corps recruiting standards. You got firefighters out there in public working out their gear, and they can actually start engaging the public with questions. I've been doing this for almost 5 years now, and I can't tell you how many times we've had incredible conversations with the public who stop and ask what to do. And also opportunity for professional development while these people go and attend these group sessions that people can just attend on their own. And then basically giving a passionate firefighter something to do with that passion. And it's been incredible. Again, I'm 5 years after applying this, and I'm actually interviewing next week Chief Brian Marcos in Smyrna, Georgia. And independent of each other, he started a program called Firefighter Prep, and basically rips off the BUDS program, which is the prep program for SEALs. He sees an incredible shift in the quality of recruits they're getting. And there's so much to it. I'm probably rambling. I got the timer on, so I don't go too far.
That's
but,
okay.
Mental health is a big part of it, because I have a phrase I built up that's called "Think Too Long Out of Gear." And what happens is something called disclosed cognition, which I'll be going over. It's an erosion of identity. You know, so when you actually start boosting morale, you get firefighters here, and they feel like firefighters. They visibly have an improved outlook. And then they keep coming back for more. It's amazing. They can work on becoming instructors, you know, as, you know, soft skills. And it basically says, tear down the silos, tear down the vision, take away the lane, respect the firefighter, want to get out there and be passionate, and so you can work on recruiting, you can work on professional development. You don't have to be in the kind of, you know, operation or and then, you know, it's just, I've just been sick of it. I'm in the same boat as the chief support speaker with 8 o'clock. I'm exhausted as well. I did 2 year work today and fostering 2 cats. So, it's the brotherhood that I thought I was going to get in the fire service that I did not get. I'm going to be showing some interviews of actual rescues that have happened to people who do gear work, and how they were before they started gear work, and how they've noticed their performance after gear work. Got some interviews that are very still. So, I think that's it.
Thanks.
Oh, yeah, go to futureReadyFire.com, because not everybody's going to be able to come to the class, and I don't care what you call it, but futureReadyFire.com. Go read up on it. If you're curious about it, give me a call. You can have it. Take it. Do what you will. That's all.
Thanks, Amanda. So those were some of the classes that will be held Monday, the 15th, from 9:15 to 10:45. And then we have some classes from 11 to 12:30. And we have Captain Matt Alto. I'm sorry if I pronounced your last name wrong.
Yeah, no, you're just fine. Thanks, Chief. So my name is Matt Alto. I'm a battalion chief out of Estacada, Oregon. For the last several years, I've had opportunity to teach with the International Association of Fire Chiefs and work with their recruitment retention certification program and building collaborative teams. And in that program, traveling around the country and talking and getting feedback, one of the things that that we always hear in a lot of fire department conversations is communication, right? The communication is a struggle, and we're not able to communicate the message we want. And then there, in turn, arises conflict and problems. And that's where this class came from, is expectations, accountability. And it really drives from making sure that we do not live in a conflict avoidance world. We become conflict avoidance masters. We have found ways to dodge the problems and to get away from the problems and not face the problems. And I'm telling you, it is something that, you know, Chief Henderson brought up about soft skills. And I started thinking about that. I'm like, there is so much more to soft skills. They are the hardest ones to learn and implement. They're just not easy to do. And so in my program, Expectations Accountability, the first thing we start to talk about in it is, you know, our formal expectations, the things that are formal in our departments. You know, things are like our SOGs, policy-based things. And then we have informal things, right? And the informal things are kind of like standby responsibilities, making coffee, you know, mopping and so forth. And when you really think about expectations in the organization, you have to think about which ones are we following up on? Which ones do we hold people accountable to? Why? Why do we do these things? And, you know, are they realistic? Do they apply to everyone? Do some of us have a policy written with our name on it because we did something wrong? And so instead of having the conversation and dealing with the issue, we just generalize, we make umbrella policies to try to solve the problems. And, you know, the reality is that a lot of this stuff comes down to understanding, setting clear expectations to your employees on the front end. Talk about profitability, productivity, reducing absenteeism, and really increasing retention. And that is the point of getting clear expectations across the board. And the benefits of them. So I talk about that. I share a couple stories about real life examples, some within the fire service and some outside of the fire service. I'm a big baseball fan, so I'll use a couple analogies with Mickey Mantle and some players from, you know, from the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s. As we get through and I start to identify some of the main priorities when it comes to setting expectations, like communication, commitment, accountability, and really coming down to coaching. The next part of the presentation, I'll get into the actual accountability, which is the conflict management side of things. And, you know, the point of conflict management, again, is accepting a culture of conflict in your organization, accepting that conflict is healthy when it's handled healthy. One of the concerns I heard from a lot of folks were, I don't know how to engage in conflict. I don't know how to approach conflict. Or when I'm dealing with very, very difficult personalities, and of course, the fire service has none of those. How do I address difficult personalities? How do I address ego? How do I approach someone that knows it all? How do I approach somebody that's going to target me? How do we go through these conversations? Because these are difficult. They're hard to do. And it's not until you've accepted a culture of conflict, a culture of, I'm okay to settle this issue. I'm going to work through this issue with you. This is where the steps in leadership really, I believe, fundamentally begin, is being able to have those difficult conversations and knowing how to get into them. I talk about removing emotion from accountability and discipline. What I mean by that is we care about our people. We care about doing what's right, and we build relationships. And removing emotion, I understand it's just not that easy. But what it can do, if you've set good expectations on the front end, and somebody makes a decision, they choose to do what's different. They choose to do what's not part of the mission, the values, and the vision statement. Then it doesn't have to involve emotion to hold people accountable. It is a part of what we do. It is a part of maintaining, defending, and supporting a culture. When you think about what our department has to offer, not just to the community, but really it's culture. And the culture is the one thing that is non-negotiable. The culture in your organization is your currency. And it is non-negotiable. It is there to support, build, and retain your membership. So as the class starts to go on, I'll start to pull in real-life examples, how to create communication habits, how to hold somebody accountable, and what those conversations can look like. I believe I built in about 15 different examples of how you can have conversations, how to have difficult conversations, arguing with strong personalities, how to deal with anxiety in an argument or making a difficult decision. How to handle somebody who is always right. Again, never in a firehouse that we've ever seen that. And how to also stop disagreements. So, and then how I wrap up the class is really conflict resolution process. We all handle conflict differently in our personal lives, and that's a culture in our home. And many of us have learned different ways to handle conflict in our professional lives. And sometimes that was maybe the currency of that administration. But developing our own methods, our own style for managing conflict and having a process is something else that I'll introduce at the end of the class. There's different steps and different acronyms that help help our folks get there. But really, when it comes down to it, the key message I'm trying to impress on our folks is 90% of the fires we fight are in the firehouse. And so becoming masters of that is really the beginning of what this course is. It's the foundation of building that to provide a set of skills that folks can take home with them, apply as they need. And my goal is if there's one thing they can take home with them, it's really the courage to have those difficult conversations and to create that culture in their firehouse.
Thank you. That class sounds like it's something that a lot of people need, actually. I'm not trying to be
funny. Hey, Lisa, can I show something to Matt real quick?
Yes, sir.
Oh, well, that looks familiar.
I just got it 3 weeks ago from Jordan and the guys here in Long Island.
Oh, it's fantastic. Yeah,
great so program. That was the challenge coin for the IAFC Recruitment and Retention Coordinator Program. Excellent program, Chief.
Oh, nice. Nice. So our next speaker will be Jada Hudson Moorfield.
Yeah. So my name is Jada Hudson, and I am a therapist. I work exclusively with first responders in Wheaton, Illinois, which is about 30 miles from Chicago. And my presentation, there's a lot of overlap here, and I can't wait to catch some of your presentations. They sound fabulous. So my presentation is on basically how to reduce rates of PTSD with a certain type of leadership style. And I call it the guardian leadership style. So I don't care who you are and how old you are. When you experience something that is very stressful and overwhelming, maybe something you've never experienced before, you're going to be looking for a parental-like figure. And that person has to know more than you, and they have to care about you. And both of those ingredients must be present in order to reduce the rates of PTSD with this type of leadership style. And I think people become leaders for maybe different reasons, right? They become leaders to make more money, to get more respect, maybe different types of duties. But hopefully that there is just this one element that they want to be this parental-like figure. They want to mentor, and they want to have this like guardian style that I'm talking about. So it's really about, like many of you have said, it's about creating attachment with each firefighter that you're in charge of. And I really do mean authentic attachment. Because for instance, if an incident, you know, goes down, it's too late if you have not built an authentic attachment to say, how are you doing? I'm worried about you. That's not going to work. It's not going to work unless you've already built those authentic attachments beforehand. So this presentation is actually just a fraction of the normal presentation. My normal presentation, I do go in depth into symptoms and diagnosis of PTSD, which I'm not going to be able to do in the time period that I'm given. So, and then I go into how to develop authentic relationships in terms of empathy training, communication style. But I'm not going to really go into that either. But those are all elements. And hopefully some of the other presenters will get into some of those topics. So again, when there's a bad incident, you can't fake an authentic relationship. And this is really, there's a lot of science behind this. It's about regulating your nervous system. There is concrete science that authentic relationships can modulate and regulate your nervous system. When your sympathetic nervous system is overreactive, having an attachment with someone, again, who cares about you and who knows more than you, will regulate that nervous system and get it back down to baseline, ultimately reducing your rates of PTSD. So these attachments that I'm talking about with your leader can return an individual to a sense of safety. And I'm literally talking about a state of safety chemically in the brain with the neurotransmitters and your sympathetic nervous system again. It's about knowing your firefighters so well on an individual level that you would know when a particular incident has impacted them, maybe for personal reasons, something they're going through at home. And then you can identify as a leader when something is wrong. So there's hard science that shows that social support or the lack of it is one of the most powerful predictors of PTSD. And there was a study done in 2008 where they took two groups of women. They shocked them, electrically shocked them while monitoring their brains. And half of the women had their spouses holding their hands. The other half did not. They were alone. And it actually showed less fear reactivity in the brain with the women who were holding their spouse's hands. So chemically, this isn't just something like, again, a feel-good thing. There is chemical science behind. behind authentic relationships, reducing rates of PTSD, as well as regulating the nervous system. I'm also going to go into training, and in particular, how to achieve a challenge appraisal versus a threat appraisal. A challenge appraisal, you go into an incident thinking that I have all the resources, both internally and externally, to get this job done. And it's an uncertain success, but I have everything I need, including the resources of my leader that cares about me. A threat appraisal, you go into an incident avoiding harm. And that's two very different things, right? And so I go into how to create trainings to create more of this challenge appraisal versus a threat appraisal. And again, I'm talking about chemicals, because if you see something as a challenge, you secrete more adrenaline, and adrenaline is proven to improve your performance. You will have a better performance, a better outcome, the more adrenaline you secrete. If you see something as a threat, you're going to secrete more cortisol. And cortisol is going to it's going to inhibit your performance. You're going to have a worse performance if you see something as a threat and you start to secrete more cortisol. So in a very particular type of training environment where you hit a sweet spot of making the trainings challenging, but not too challenging and not too boring. So, and that's very hard to do. I've talked with a number of fire departments here in the Chicago area, small and large, including Chicago. And so, you know, this aspect of training, you know, it's different for every department. And I welcome some conversation in my presentation of ideas, because it's much easier to do at a smaller department where you know everyone and you know their ability levels, and you can create sort of that unique training environment on an individual basis. So I talk a little bit about how to set up trainings at the sweet spot that I'm talking about. And I'm also talk about how to create a physiological toughness through exercise, which can also create a challenge appraisal to an incident. So I'm talking military special ops, Green Beret kind of thing, where you are training your body very strenuously under very strenuous conditions. And you're literally, it's more than getting your body strong and tough. It's about training your nervous system. So you're training your nervous system, again, to reach this chemical level that I'm talking about of this adrenaline and increasing your performance. So it's about having a very stressful condition. This is what the military does, right? They train these very stressful conditions. You have a sense of control, and then you follow that with an adequate recovery. You can also do this with HIIT training. So you can do that with the high intensity interval training. So working super hard and then resting. And you're actually training and regulating your nervous system to be able to work very hard and then master, you know, the chemicals in your body. So I talk a little bit about that. And then finally, I think some of the other presenters maybe have hit on this a little bit, but a task versus relational leadership. So you can't be relational all the time. If you're going into an incident, going into a fire, you can't be relational at that time. You have to work on your task orientation. So you have to work on your SOPs. You have to do your standards. You have to do basic quick command language. And get the job done, right? Very practical things. But you also, just like, you know, firefighters have to flip that switch on and off all the time, you have to flip to the relational side too, which is more of that empathy for somebody, getting to know somebody, taking the time to have those conversations. And there's specific times before, during, and after an incident that you have to switch back and forth to these different leadership styles. And finally, I'm going to touch a little bit on psychological safety and how important it is in your fire department to have people feel comfortable to express themselves, at least. You know, everyone doesn't have to agree, because you are going to get the best creative problem solving out of them if they feel psychologically safe just to at least express their opinions. So there's definitely a lot to cover. I'm looking forward to presenting this year, and I'm looking forward to having conversations with different leaders from all over the world.
Thank you for that information. Our classes from 2 to 3:30 will feature Elisa Arnoff.
Hi, Lisa.
Hi.
This is Elisa Arnoff. I am an attorney. I also am in the Chicago area, but a different portion than where Jada is. I work really closely with Women in Fire. My work is in the area of employment law, and I've been working in the fire service since 2010. Really briefly, my program is a risk management program. It's designed for newly promoted company officers or for people who are wishing to promote, or for those of you that just can't get enough of HR law and really want to see what's going on. I like to say it's not your HR department's EEO program, which is not to give short shrift to what HR puts on, but this is really at a much higher level. It's not basic, it's fire and EMS specific, and it's what you as a leader, somebody who wants to be a leader, needs to know, and how your responsibilities have changed given that you now have a command role. We know that fire and EMS is different because it's not a 9-to-5 job. Briefly, first, we're going to focus on the discrimination, harassment, and retaliation laws. I will have a specific focus on gender discrimination for two reasons. One, we're women in fire. And two, when we tend to do our surveys, we see in the fire service that most of our complaints fall under gender discrimination. And secondly, fall under race discrimination. We're going to talk about religious accommodation, which is always coming up in the fire service with respect to grooming, clothing standards, hair standards. I'm going to talk a lot about retaliation, because when I get the retaliation case, that's when I'm going to be able to retire. We're going to talk about what retaliation is. We're going to do what I call the quick thinks, which will be some exercises based on recent cases, kind of a what would you do. I'm going to talk about the scary thing of personal liability and what you need to do to protect yourself. I'm going to give you a quick rundown on documentation. Really, it's just how to do it quickly and to cover yourself. And finally, we're going to talk about working on your expectations. And Chief Alto, you talked about expectations with respect to what you're talking about. And with respect to this program, I want those in the class to be able to, you know, at least by the time they walk out, be thinking about what their expectations are from an equal employment opportunity standpoint for their shift, for their house, and for their agency, to identify what resources they need to meet those expectations and to figure out how to prioritize them. Obviously, I'm biased about my program. I've been doing it for a number of years, but I think it's really important because I think, as all of us here know, most complaints, most lawsuits in the fire service come from within, come from our own personnel. And my hope is that we can start changing the paradigm. So I'm looking forward to Indianapolis. Thanks for having me.
At least I have a quick question. Are you going to also be using case studies to?
Yes. Yeah. So on the quick thinks, those questions for the audience will be coming off of recent cases. And those will be updated as close as we can get to the conference.
Okay, cool. Thank you. I appreciate that. And our next speaker will be Superintendent from the U.S. Fire Administration, Eric Gablix.
Yep, you got it. So over the last 2 years, a lot of you know Dr. Lori Moore Merrill, the U.S. Fire Administrator, has brought together all of our national fire service organizations under an effort called Fire Service One Voice. As part of that, we have hosted two national summits that actually have had international attendance, but those summits have been used to work with Fire Service One Voice to identify the national concerns of the fire service. And by fire service, that includes everyone in the fire service, career volunteer combination. That group, as part of the summit, has identified a number of priorities Obviously, cancer is number one, not only within the U.S., but internationally. Mental health of our first responders, our climate challenges, especially with wildfires, codes and standards. And then the one I'm going to talk about is recruitment or retention. So if you think about cancer being a concern, mental health being a concern, when somebody Googles being a firefighter, those are two things that come up. So if you're in the business of recruiting people today to come into your organization, what is your organization doing to address cancer and mental health through resources available through proactive policies, procedures, by changing the culture of the organization? So the recruitment or retention work group has been very busy over the last 2 years. And we're going to share the work of that as part of the presentation. So coming out of that recruitment and retention work group, International Association of Firefighters is working with Department of Labor on an apprenticeship model. We're already seeing that in some parts of the country with very good success. Our partners from the National Volunteer Fire Council are working with the Department of Education on something known as CTE, Comprehensive Technical Education, not only our community colleges, but also in our high school VOTEC program. So getting youth interested in potential opportunities earlier than later. And then also the third edition coming out of last year's summit is a national strategy to market the fire service opportunities, not just for men and women, not just because of color, religion, rural, urban, suburban are all looking for people to be in the fire service, and not everybody in the fire service has to be a firefighter. So we're looking for EMTs, paramedics, we're looking for plans examiners, fire inspectors, community risk reduction specialists, and the list goes on and on. So we're going to talk about the summit, but then we're going to switch gears and talk about what's working across the country. So the recruitment and retention work group has identified more than 45 different programs across the country that we see as best practices. And not that this is an endorsement of any of these programs, but what we've done is identified groups that are doing something innovative, something that's been successful. And we're going to share those with everybody in attendance. So as much as we hear doom and gloom, nobody wants to work in the fire service, there are actually departments that are not struggling to find people. So we're going to showcase those as part of the presentation. So appreciate the opportunity to be with you tonight, and I look forward to seeing everybody at FDIC in Indianapolis.
Thank you. That is some very interesting information that you just shared. I just do have one quick question. I know, like in California, if you look on any social media, you see how many every department is hiring, and they're hiring lateral firefighters, entry level firefighters, and stuff. Is that across the whole United States that everyone's having a hard time getting firefighters, or is it just...
No, there are departments that are truly not struggling to find people. I would say that the lists of people, hundreds and thousands applying to be a firefighter, are no longer there. Yeah. But that's the reality that we've got the lowest unemployment now in the United States after many decades. Everybody's looking for that career opportunity. If you are looking to enter the marketplace, you are... if you will, in a seller's market. So the opportunity is to you. And a lot of people may be applying to multiple fire departments at one time to be a career firefighter. So time to hire is an issue. So if some department's going to not get back to you for 9 months and another one calls you within 30 days, you're probably going to take that opportunity. So the salaries are more competitive. We are seeing people do lateral hires with some compensation bonuses. But I would say that's not unique to the fire service. We've seen that in nursing. We've seen that in school teachers. But the fire service is doing that also because it's working. It's not working everywhere. Not everybody's able to do that. But we're going to cover a lot of different strategies that are out there. So great question, Lisa.
Thank you. I look forward to that class, actually. Our next presenter will be Chief over Fire EMS and Special Operations, David Pruitt.
Awesome. Once again, thanks to everybody. I've been sitting here scribbling notes just on what y'all are talking about, and truly wish I could be at all the presentations and stuff. Thankful to be a part of the conference and a part of the week at FDIC. Indy's such a great time. What my presentation is over actually kind of encompasses what I feel is a beginning point to where so many of y'all have started. And that's in our performance evaluation. The class is called A Passionate Pursuit, the 7 P's. It's something my dad had always said. It came out of the military. Prior proper planning prevents piss poor performance. And throughout my life, he had told me that when things went awry, I turned in a paper late or a last minute thing, he'd be there with that sage advice. And it finally started taking hold that I wasn't really preparing. And at 3 p.m., 3 a.m., whenever it is when we show up to that person's front yard, whether it be a medical, a law enforcement event, a fire, a wreck, so many times we are doing an improv act for them. We haven't truly prepared. We haven't gone outside of our areas to make that one-time performance for them be what it should be. And that is perfection. Even though we have frequent flyers and people we see on a somewhat regular basis, we're in the one-time performance business. And I say it in the class, if the next call you ran, they wrote you a check for your entire salary for the year based off your performance on that next call, how would you prepare for it? Now, I'm very fortunate I came out of an education background and a music background. My degree's in music education. I've been fortunate to perform with some of the top singers in the world and performers. And I've been to venues where people pay hundreds and thousands of dollars to be there to see something, to be transported to a world that they don't normally live in. When the bells drop, that's our moment. They did not plan on seeing us. And if we were truly honest with ourselves, and this is what the class focuses on, we touch on the things. What's it look like prior? What's the event? Amanda was talking about her time in the military. They planned for events they knew were going to happen based on historical data. How many times do we do it with our incumbent members, let alone the new guy or gal walking in? We play the what if game. Well, what if this happens? What if? I propose we've got to stop that. We know exactly what's going to happen. There are very few times we are surprised. Now, there's times, obviously, we don't want it to happen, but we know the calls that are going to happen. We can look back in my old department. We have the journals dating back to 1883 when our department was founded. And it's you. We see the same calls popping up time and time again for 140 years of our existence. How am I surprised that they've asked me to go do this? And more importantly, why am I not prepared for it? Now, I take it, and it actually makes my dad upset, and he'll be in Indy at some point in the week. Do we plan and prepare forever? I'll challenge, yes, we should be in that constant state of preparation. But as prior proper planning prevents piss poor performance, and I wrote it down, and he's got me going on it. At a certain point, our planning can create proactive performers. How much more of a mindset change when you come into our building, we tell you what our performance expectations are. We live those out from mopping the floor to stretching the hose, everything. And I wish it was happening every day. I'm not going to lie and say it's not happening or it's happening every day in my agency, but we challenge the guys to do fire ground behavior 24/7. Whether they're on a medical, as some of y'all have heard me say it before on other shows, as soon as they touch that patient, one of them will say victim, 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 and start looking for a way out alternatively. We did it the other day on a CPR we were running. If this place we were having to move to the ground as we would with a CPR, now we've got to do this. We're in limited mobility range. We went back and we did an AAR. We had realistic measures, performance indicators that we've actually taken out of the business world and other areas. Other people that have multi-million dollar, billion dollar industries based off of service, we are the original service industry. It is a shame that we should even have to look. They should be looking to us. How is the fire service serving people? That's how we're going to do it at Walmart. That's how we're going to do it at Starbucks. That's how we're going to do it at the lemonade stand down the street. I get carried away and get going. I am passionate about this. That's why it's called that and pursuing that. I think we're at a time in our industry in the next 10 to 15 years, the voices that are present, many of them on this the show tonight, we're going to have textbooks written the way we know they should be. We're going to have academies deliver to students that performance expectation from the time they sign up. That way, when they come into our firehouses, we're not having to reteach them. Here's real life. No, we taught it from the beginning because we've taken control of the performance metrics from the very beginning of our industry. And wow, when they come, when they run me in the nursing home, I hope they're like, oh yeah, you're that crazy guy from this that said all these things, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago. And so I, once again, I'm excited to be a part of it. I love to hear the stories from everybody because we dive those rabbit holes. What are you actually preparing for? And a few of them, obviously in the time frame, we can't do a lot of them, but we'll back those up to, okay, wow, there's certain things that will take you a year or two to accomplish. And there's certain things we could be ready for right now because we know those metrics. We create those metrics and we live those out. Once again, thank y'all for having me on tonight. Love to be a part of the conference.
Thank you. And then also from 3:45 to 5:15 is John Oates, who is a president and CEO of the International Public Safety Data Institute. Welcome.
Thank you, Lisa, and appreciate the opportunity to share tonight a little bit about my presentation. My fire service background is 33 years in the career fire service, all in Central Connecticut, across a couple different organizations, two career departments, a couple volunteer departments. And then I had the opportunity to take on this role where I am the lead for the Public Safety Data Institute, which is home of N4's analytics, the exposure tracker, and some other things. And was always a data-minded fire chief. And now that I do it all the time, you start looking at where our gaps are and where the things are that we don't do good. And then like, how do we measure stuff? And how do we measure what matters? And how do we like, we do all these crazy little things that don't matter. And I'll take away something that David mentioned. I'm going to back all the way back up even before we like worry about personnel evaluations or mission or anything. It's like, how do we define what we're doing? So my presentation can be a little like I had somebody tell me the title could get somebody punched in the mouth. But if you spend enough time in the fire service, you probably could. It's called What's Your Problem? And it's like you can think that in the attitude and the voice and the lexicon of the last person that said that to you in the firehouse. Because I'm sure all of us, like at some point, somebody's like, what's your problem? But it was designed that for a reason, that when we think about the problems from the simplest, most mundane things we run across to the wicked problems that Robert talked about, do we really do a good job of figuring out what the actual problem is? We talk about stuff and we say, well, it's this, it's that. It's like, well, what do we really do to dissect that and to figure out what the root of the problem is? Because 9 times out of 10, we're just nudging around the edges. You know, we think we have a people problem. So half the departments you work for, what do they do with a people problem? They're going to transfer them to another fire station to think that magically that's going to heal them. Well, that's a bunch of crap. That's not going to do it. So, and we look at it from a boss perspective too. Anybody that's a chief officer or even a battalion chief or a division head, you're getting beat over the head all the time. Well, your overtime's too high and you're costing us too much money. And I'm like, okay, well, let's take that apart. What are the primary drivers of overtime? What puts that together? What causes it? What can you plan for? What can't you plan for? What's a realistic number? Which no community is planning for. Like every community that I've ever been affiliated with or spent any time around, like everybody for a career department, your overtime budget's running a negative somewhere around Labor Day, just because they either didn't fund it right or they didn't calculate it right or whatever. So it's like, let's take that apart. Let's figure out what those primary drivers are. I was fortunate in the career department when I was fire chief, had a phenomenal risk manager at the end. She's fantastic. The ones before her, not so much. And it was always like, well, your injury rate's too high. You're getting too many people injured. The injuries are too serious. This isn't, and this is a department that prided itself on health, wellness, fitness, doing all the right things, tremendous wellness program, medical, physical program, all the things you want to do. And we're still getting beat over the head with it. It's like, okay, let's take that apart. Is it one really, really big injury that's driving that off the chart? Or do we have this repetitive little aggravating thing that's just a nature of what we run into because we know what the injury types are that we develop over time in the fire service and we've been really, really active, and we're running a bunch of stuff, and like everybody else, we don't have enough people. So everybody on the fire ground is doing like 97 jobs. Well, guess what? You know that, and as the department ages, that's going to make a difference. So what is that problem? Is it, yeah, we had a couple of catastrophic injuries that perhaps we can do something about. We, you know, we ran a ton of EMS like everybody else. Very old New England city, had a lot of sketchy places to, from a building construction aspect, to pull patients out of. So you get knees, hips, shoulders, back injuries. Like, look, until you make us a community that's flat with a bunch of 24, 48 ranches with no basement that we can wheel people out a double wide door in the front, that's going to happen. But how do we do that? How do we fix it? How do we define it? What do we do with it? And then how do we explain that with zero jargon, with zero fire service terminology, with a little bit of math, back to the people that are paying the bills or creating the ruckus to begin with? And again, I sit from the on the front. Sometimes it's your boss. Sometimes it's a community group. You need a community group. It's like, look, we want more money spent on libraries. And I love libraries. I love books. I read a ton. But we want more money spent on the library than we do in your fire department. It's like, all right, well, how do we quantify that return on investment for the dollars that you spend on your fire department? In most places, even career combination, wildland, industrial, you know, they are big budget drivers. And how do we explain? And I encourage people not to use, I don't use the word justify. We explain, we educate, we identify, we help people understand. Because justify, the minute you say justify, it puts people in a defensive posture. Well, you have to justify what you're doing. I'll tell you what, let's go through some education. Let's have a conversation. Let me lay it out for you and explain why we do how we do and how those numbers add up and how we got to be that way. The challenge for a lot of us too is this is not a one and done. As soon as you get everyone to understand this, whether it's bosses, whether it's community groups, whether it's elected officials, whether it's other people in City Hall that you deal with, guess what? They're going to move on to another job. They're not going to get reelected. They're going to get promoted. They're going to move to a different city. So now we have to, I went through it a couple of times. I was fire chief for 13 years across three different mayors, a couple of different city council iterations. Like every time we got to the point, we're like, all right, they understand all this stuff. Nope. Let's do it all over again. So we talk about a bunch of stuff like that. And then the last one that I do is something that we hear very often. And I'm sure everybody in the room has heard it one time or another, is that person is a terrible firefighter, or that person is a blank, pick your term. And I'm like, all right, by what objective standard? And that's the problem we run into, is often it's a person's opinion. It's probably a person that perhaps if you applied, and I talk about it all the time, you need to hold yourself to the same standard everybody else to. And that's, we have a problem with that sometimes in the fire service. So it's like, okay, well, if you're going to say that this person is underperforming and is not doing their job and is not meeting expectations, it's like, what is the objective, not subjective, but what is the objective standard that identifies that? And then if you're a boss, what are you doing about it? Because it's one thing to go like, you're pretty terrible. Like, I'm not saying that you're a bad human, but I'm saying you're a pretty terrible firefighter. It's like, all right, well, guess what? You're their boss. You should have been fixing them. You should be working on making them better all the way along. Because it's not, in part, you know, if you think about every single attitude problem that you've ever encountered in the fire service, I will argue with you that we created that for you. That person did not walk in the door being grouchy. That person did not walk in the door feeling like the organization did them dirty or whatever. We did that to them. So we need to help them undo that, whatever that looks like in your system. So we're gonna cover a ton of material in a pretty short period of time. I massively appreciate the opportunity from Women in Fire to contribute to your conference. I think it's an exciting time, and I look forward to sharing those three and a bunch more when we talk about what people's problems are and how we can find a way around it. So thank you for having me tonight.
Thank you. So we're almost out of time here. So as you've heard, we have some really excellent classes at our leadership conference with some, as you've heard, some phenomenal speakers. I'm really looking forward to attending some of these classes now that I've heard some of you speak on these classes. So thank you to all the guests for being a part of our radio show. Thank you to all being presenters at the leadership conference in Indianapolis as part of FDIC. Thank you to Fire Engineering again. Thanks to all the listeners and members of Women in Fire. And you could follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn, and check out our website, which is womeninfire.org.